Cancer, HIV, ALS, Huntington's, cystic fibrosis are just some of the serious, long-lasting diseases for which we are routinely told that a cure is just around the corner. But is all that emphasis and hope riding on a cure for these diseases displaced? And what does a cure even mean? Jason Kevler, a staff writer at Vice's Motherboard, has written an article about a friend who died of cystic fibrosis and the vast research industry that surrounds the CF and other diseases. It's called The Cure Culture, and we have a link to it on our show page at WMIC.org. I'm very pleased to welcome Jason to our show today. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
How do you define what you call the cure culture?
Right. The cure culture is just what you mentioned, the idea that we are going to cure these diseases that people are born with, or even diseases we acquire like HIV. It's something that, as a science journalist, you see all the time in sort of press releases and in the media in general. A cure is coming, a cure is around the corner. This clinical trial showed promising results, and we're going to get rid of this thing that we've had since the dawn of time in some cases.
And you say that there are political, economic, and social reasons we focus on cures?
There is. And I chose to focus on cystic fibrosis because that's what my friend Caitlin had. And in that case, there's a foundation called the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation that has done a lot of great work for people with CF. But it's easier to promise someone a cure versus we can make you live a little bit longer. It's a little bit more compelling. And the CFF survives based on donations, and it's a little bit easier to get money from, say, Congress or the NIH if you're able to say, hey, we're getting really close to curing this thing, versus, hey, we have a drug that might help make treatments a little bit easier or might extend life, a little bit.
So are they kind of playing a game there?
I don't know if
they do. Do you think they're sincere and hoping that there really is a cure just around the corner?
Right. I mean, I think we are moving towards a cure all the time, and I don't think that a cure is totally hopeless. But I think at the same time, there needs to be a focus put on helping people who already have the disease, because a cure at this point is something for people who are not born yet often. It's something that, we may have 15, 20 years down the line. And when you have people who have a disease where the life expectancy is 20, 30 years, you are basically helping out people who are not born yet.
You, as you mentioned, you focus on cystic fibrosis because your friend Caitlin had it. So let's talk about cystic fibrosis for a moment. What causes it?
It's a genetic disease. It's a recessive genetic disease. So your parents can both be carriers, or if one parent is a carrier and one has it, or both parents have it, you can get the disease. And like I mentioned in the story, there is no cure. There's many different treatments for it, and it's primarily lung and pancreatic disease. Many people die of lung complications. Caitlin died of pneumonia. But it's also a pancreatic disease in which it's kind of difficult to digest food. So every time you eat anything with fat in it, you have to take a certain number of enzymes to help digest, and it's hard to keep weight on. And so Caitlin had to eat a lot of food all the time, could never keep on weight. And a lot of people with CF eventually developed diabetes, which is a whole other complication.
Did the people who she knew know she had cystic fibrosis?
Her close friends definitely knew. And I found out pretty quickly after meeting her because we were very close. But she did hide it from, say, her classmates and her coworkers. And, she coughed all the time. So people often thought she was sick or thought she was a smoker. She was not a smoker. But she tried her best to hide it. And I think a lot of people do.
Many long-term diseases like cystic fibrosis, also cancer, HIV, others have communities online or in support groups where people talk about their illness and new treatment options. Did she want to be part of anything like that?
She was not terribly interested in the fact that she had the disease. I think it was more of like a hindrance and annoyance for her, obviously a very bad one, because she had to do what's called breathing treatments for 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours at night. So she was never forgetting that she had it. But at the same time, she was an actress. She was in school. She didn't have time to kind of focus on the fact that she had the disease.
Although a lot of people with those kinds of illnesses consider it a part of who they are.
A lot of them do. And, you know, it was a part of who she was, but it was not her identity. And I don't think there's anything wrong if that is your identity, but for her, it just wasn't.
Did she talk about the search for a cure? Or was that beyond her ken?
We talked often about being better about her treatments because it was such a long... It took 2 hours a day, and, you know, if you are going to school all day and you have work afterwards, you know, by the time you're done and ready to go to sleep, it could be 2 a.m. You have to wake up at 6 a.m. And so she'd skip them from time to time, and then you feel worse the next day. So we talked about that, and we talked about getting better treatments because there are nebulizers, or were nebulizers available in Europe and Canada that could have cut this down to, say, 15, 20 minutes.
Go ahead, finish.
And those were not FDA approved until earlier this year.
How old was she when she died?
She was 25.
You write, I'm quoting you, "I'm not mad that she died. I'm mad that society told me she would live."
Yeah. So as a journalist, I read articles all the time. And I, even in high school, we took a genetics class. And in that textbook, it said, "A cystic fibrosis cure is on the way." In 1989, when the gene that causes cystic fibrosis was discovered, there was a plethora of stories saying gene therapy is going to cure this. And if you read those articles then, they're not really that different from the articles you read now.
Gene therapy is still something that is being experimented with. I think there was a recent Chinese attempt that failed.
Right.
But isn't hope important for many people suffering with disease?
Hope certainly is very important, and I think it is important to varying degrees to different people. And Caitlin never talked about being cured. I know that some people get strength off of the fact that maybe if they, you know, hold out long enough, there will be a cure. And I don't begrudge anyone that at all. It just wasn't necessarily my experience with her.
My guess is Jason Kepler's written an article called "The Cure Culture" for Vice's Motherboard. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and I'd like to open this up for listener calls. Are you dealing with a long-term illness like cancer, HIV, or cystic fibrosis, or ALS? Are you holding out hope for a cure? Do you think that resources searching for a cure would be better spent on finding new treatments? Give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You say that funding often goes into moonshot ideas to cure illnesses.
Right. So after the gene was discovered in 1989, a lot of funding was shifted to gene therapy, which at the time we weren't exactly sure how it would work, and we weren't sure if it would work. And so there wasn't many new treatments developed during the 1990s. And recently that's changed because there were, you know, some small research projects that eventually grew into something. But, you know, at the same time, all this was pushed to something that was going to, in theory, take a while to come about.
Although I'd imagine for anybody getting involved in the research, there's always the hope of the Nobel Prize somewhere down the line. In the case of cystic fibrosis, why was gene therapy considered the most promising approach?
It was considered promising because it's a genetic disease, and they found out what the faulty gene was. So, I mean, there was one doctor quoted, and it was an NIH doctor, it was a University of Pennsylvania doctor, I believe, and he said, you know, all you have to do is put the new gene in, deliver it through a cold virus, and they thought that that would work. And it was actually kind of weird that they pitched it as a cure because gene therapy would be something that you'd need to do every couple months. So it's even that is something of a maintenance type situation.
But perhaps it seemed more promising because very few non-infectious illnesses have been cured, and this seems like a logical way. Right now there's a new thing called that's the equivalent of gene writing, where they kind of correct the spellings of genes, and many people are finding that promising.
Right, yeah, that's called CRISPR. And, I mean, I believe that could lead to some cures for some of these diseases. I think that it's more likely we'll cure people before they're born. You know, we'll edit the embryo before they're born, at least at first. I don't know that we can do that in a living
And isn't that a major concern as well? If you have an advanced stage of an illness, pretty much all these cures would be irrelevant to your life. You just would be happy for other people who will come after you.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's absolutely true. I think that some people get a lot of joy out of that, and maybe others less so. And obviously, I'm not saying we shouldn't be trying to research cures. We certainly should. But I think that we also need to talk about the fact that there are people who have diseases now that need help, and there are ways we can help them, and we're not necessarily always doing that.
And hasn't gene therapy also sometimes led to disaster? One patient, Jesse Gelsinger, who was part of a study into gene therapy, didn't have cystic fibrosis, but he died.
Right, yeah, that was kind of a catastrophic failure in... It's a famous case because he was the first person to die from gene therapy. And after he died, he wasn't totally sick when he died. He was doing it for research. And after he died, so much funding was shifted back away from gene therapy.
Well, there are other issues there. Didn't the main researcher violate safety protocols and have money invested in a biotech company?
Yeah, that's why it's such a disaster, because, you know, he did have something riding on this trial, and it turned out that they put this guy in the trial when maybe he was a little bit, you know, worse off than expected.
We are going to be taking calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692, and I'd also like to open up the conversation to health professionals. Do patients with major, often terminal diseases regularly seek out experimental cures for their ailments? How do you balance hope with realism? Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WMIC.org. Philip from Stamford, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Leonard, I just enjoy your show. I'm a faithful listener. Thank you. And this topic really hit home with me. I have retinitis pigmentosa, a degenerative retinal disease, and I've been losing my sight slowly over the past 30 years. And I'm caught up in this culture as well with the Foundation Fighting Blindness and other charities who do a lot of pressure tactics to raise money for research. But as you mentioned just now, there's really nothing for me now to help me either cope or treatments that would maybe halt the disease process or something. And it's very frustrating. And this topic really just made me want to call and give my two cents.
Now, are there any treatments that can at least slow the process down?
Not really. There is one FDA-approved treatment through the Massachusetts Eye and Ear with vitamin therapy, vitamin A palmitate and fish oils. And some people respond to that, others don't. But I tend to think that there's no emphasis or supporting of these treatments because they want the money to go into the research for the cure. That's where the big money is.
And in many of these illnesses, people enroll themselves into quite experimental studies because they have a feeling they have nothing to lose. If somebody said to you, we have this study that we're working on, it could be dangerous, but it also could save your sight, would you be inclined to try?
I have thought about that. There are some great studies and through Columbia in the city. And unfortunately for me, most of these studies will only take someone when they're at the end and there's very, very little sight, either perception of light or color or motion. And, you know, fortunately, I'm blessed to have a little bit remaining sight. I'd use a white cane. I'm in the process of getting a guide dog. And just the sight I do have is much more than most people do have. So they're reluctant to have me risk what I do have at this point.
Thanks a lot for your call, Philip.
My pleasure.
Our number, again, is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. My guest is Jason Kebler. Jason, do you think your friend Caitlin's doctors were realistic about her prospects?
I think they were. I think they often were overly realistic because, you know, they would say you have a couple years left from time to time, which was always difficult for her to hear. And, you know, even though she tried very hard not to show it, she did, you know, every time she went to the doctor, she came home kind of reeling off of that.
Well, Are there ethical ways to give patients hope, but to also let them know that their situation may be hopeless?
I'd be interested to hear what doctors think about that, because I haven't really had to deliver news like that to someone. But I think I did speak to a couple bioethicists about this, and they said we are more hopeful in the United States than any other country is. You know, you have people who are tied to life support for years at a time, whereas he said, you know, in Britain they would have been buried for, the funeral would be over, you know, by the time we're even considering taking people off life support. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but it is an interesting thing about our culture.
Well, it winds up getting into the political realm again. That's something Jeb Bush is going to have to deal with as he tries to run for president.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, this is such a hard area, and that's why I don't want to say, you know, this is good or this is bad or this is black and this is white. It's just another, there's gray, or shades of gray here, and we need to consider them, and I don't think we always do.
You also spoke with Joshua Stokel, a researcher. What was his situation?
So Joshua Stokel was a cystic fibrosis researcher who had cystic fibrosis, and I called him up at the end of May. And he basically studied his microbiome of his lungs for several years and published a few papers about it, because people with cystic fibrosis are very susceptible to lung infections. And while I was fact-checking this story, I went and made sure I had everything correct and found out that he actually died a week after I spoke with him, which was quite a shock and upsetting.
He was a researcher, so he really knew all the ins and outs of cystic fibrosis.
He did, yeah.
And he still couldn't keep himself alive.
He couldn't. He was 36, so he lived a somewhat long life for someone with CF. But after I published the story, his girlfriend actually wrote to me and said that my story touched her. And she said, you know, Josh wasn't expecting to die. They had just put money down to buy a house. They just, you know, were about to get married. I think they were engaged. And he died kind of out of the blue. And, you know, Josh had a maybe more favorable outlook on this cure culture we've created. But at the same time, he said, you know, it was frustrating seeing that I was supposed to be cured. I was supposed to be cured. And once he became a researcher, he realized that he never would be.
My guest is Jason Kebler. His article for Vice's Motherboard is The Cure Culture, and we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page, WMIC.org, or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We'll be back with your calls and more about this topic after we take a brief break. Stay with us. And we are back with Jason Kebler, who is a staff writer at Vice's Motherboard. We're talking about the implications of his article, The Cure Culture, and inviting your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write to our show page at WMIC.org, on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate, and we're inviting people who have, on both sides of this story, the people who have an illness that where a cure is being sought and who really just have to deal with day-to-day treatment, and also with people in the medical profession who have to address these issues. And Susan from Trenton, New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'm a nurse, and my husband has multiple sclerosis, so I deal with disease on both sides of the fence. And I just wanted to call in because I think that in searching for cures, we often find really good treatments. And there's been a lot of new treatments that have come out that have really helped a lot of patients with chronic illnesses. The second thing is I think there is a lot of things wrong with our medicine in the United States, but I believe that the doctors need to be better trained in discussing hospice and palliative care and end-of-life issues with their patients, no matter what age they are. And that's something that really sticks in my craw personally, because I see a lot of patients who really should be spoken to about end of life, and their doctors are still saying, oh, you're going to be fine, everything, let's just do this one more treatment over here, let's try this, let's try that, and it's just not realistic.
Is the situation for your husband similar to what we've been discussing with cystic fibrosis? Is MS in pretty much the same situation as far as cure and treatment?
Yes. There is no cure for MS. There are only treatments. It's been the same treatment probably for the past 50 years, which is basically beta seron injections. They are coming out with more and more treatments for relapsing remitting. Unfortunately, a lot of relapsing remitting patients go into secondary progressive, and there's not a lot of treatment for that.
Now, is also the kind of a talk of a possible cure through gene therapy or something else?
That I haven't heard. I do know that a lot of the genome therapy that they're working on in stem cell has done a lot for cancer treatment and diabetes. I had a patient who had part of the pancreas removed and the same part, like an organ transplant, only it was not the whole pancreas. And they ended up cured from their diabetes because they got this treatment.
Thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now, stem cell research has also been dangled as a possible cure for all of these things, but we haven't seen anything real, really tangible come out of it.
Right. I mean, there have been a few therapies that have grown out of stem cell, but not in the way that we talk about it, like you will be able to regrow your arm or you'll be able to regrow, you know, organs and things of that nature. It's
well,
just
people
not
with spinal
yet.
Injuries sometimes are told they could, and then right. There are any number of things like cystic fibrosis and multiple sclerosis that have where it's been suggested that stem cells can help in the end, right. But right. Nothing's happened.
Yeah, not yet. And you know, she just mentioned that we get a lot of new treatments from searching for a cure, and that is true. But at the same time, there are treatments out there right now that at least patients with CF don't have access to all the time, either because they're only available in other countries or because it's such an expensive disease to treat. And I would imagine MS is the same. There were times when Caitlin had to skip getting a prescription because she couldn't afford it. And that's often the case with people with CF because it's an every single day sort of thing. And the CF Foundation estimates that 30% of CF patients will have to skip treatments at some point because they don't have enough money.
Sharon, from you're on 195 and I-95 in New Jersey. Oh, Sharon's no longer there. Now let's talk a bit about the pharmaceuticals. There's an article in today's Times about how some states are looking into the incredible prices of some of the treatments that are available, trying to get the pharmaceutical companies to be a little more transparent on just how much R&D and other kinds of research cost as a justification for these incredible prices of drugs. Do you think that that's all part of the same problem here? The drugs are a lot cheaper in other parts of the world.
Right. So this is interesting, and at the moment it's specific to cystic fibrosis, at least with regard to two new drugs. They're called Kalydeco and Orkambi, and they're both developed by a company called Vertex. And these are basically pause buttons for CF. You take one pill or two pills a day, every day, and you still need to do your breathing treatments, but in theory it shouldn't get any worse. And a prescription for Kalydeco costs $300,000 per patient per year.
Who's picking up the tab?
insurance companies at the moment, or sometimes Medicare, sometimes Medicaid. But, you know, there have been cases where Medicare won't pick it up, and there have been lawsuits relating to it as well.
How does a pharmaceutical company ever come up with that kind of price point for a drug?
So cystic fibrosis is a disease that has many different types of mutations that cause it. And the one that Kalydeco treats only has about 2,000 patients in the United States. And I spoke to one CF researcher and doctor about how they come to this price point. And they basically say, okay, we spent X billion of dollars developing this, and there's 2,000 patients who can use it. So divide that number by the other one, and you come out with $300,000 per patient per year. And he said, you know, it's the case where the second pill costs $5 to make, but the first one costs $4 billion to make. And this is going to increasingly become a problem as we move towards personalized medicine and get better at sequencing genomes, because, you know, you're going to start dividing patients into smaller and smaller groups. And when there's not a huge market for a certain drug, the price kind of necessarily must be higher if the research costs are higher. And a lot of researchers are saying that this is unsustainable. I mean, it's unsustainable for the insurance companies, it's unsustainable for the pharmaceutical companies developing the drugs, and it's certainly unsustainable for the patients.
Let's take another call. Monica, you're on the Triborough Bridge, Monica?
Now I have to pull over because I actually took a while for you to take my call, but let me get to the issue. So I was calling in connection with your guest in terms of the cost of a cure, and I don't mean the financial cost, I mean the medical and physical cost of a cure. My mother had endometrial cancer, and she was treated and cured, but at what cost? At the cost of being able to eat or drink anything. And she was left forced to be nourished through something called TPN, which is basically, pumped amino acids through your vascular system. It doesn't even go through your digestive system, because her digestive system was so destroyed by surgery, radiation, and scar tissue that the surgery and the radiation produced. And the second thing is that in terms of remedies, she ended up becoming able to eat again by virtue of an unconventional remedy that the conventional doctors with whom she worked had no interest in whatsoever. But she spent 5 years in agony.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that, first of all. And second, that's a good point. I mean, often who wants to find a cure? You know, it's often the parents and friends and researchers want to find a cure. But if you ask Caitlin, I'm sure she would have loved a cure, but at what cost? You know, she was living her life. She was an actress. She was in school. She had a very nice life. And I think a lot of people with chronic illnesses believe that they have a nice life. And to focus solely on a cure is to suggest that, you know, maybe you can't live a full life and with this disease, which isn't always the case.
And the alternative treatment, like I said, that ultimately enables her to soften the scar tissue sufficiently to allow her to eat and drink in small quantities, and, you know, really getting off the TPN meant getting off of a constant, specter of sepsis, which is a terrible condition to have and which she had many, many times. So not only did it give her quality of life in terms of the social and physical pleasures of eating and drinking again, but also, you know, freed her from a lot of physical complications due to the TPN. And that cure came about, you know, just by dint of relentless searching by us into alternative approaches. And like I said, the conventional doctors didn't want to know about it.
Monica, thank you so much for your call. This reminds me that it was the patients who fought to get treatments for HIV/AIDS at a time when there seemed to be quite a bit of resistance to even doing much research into it, because it was affecting mostly homosexuals and drug users.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great allegory. That's very That's the case, and many of these with many of these diseases. I mean, one of the articles I cited in my story was a study from 1999 in which a researcher interviewed hundreds of CF patients, and they all said nothing is here for us. There's nothing. The CF Foundation is doing a great job researching a cure, but they're not doing a great job supporting us.
Well, why can't they help bring the price down for the drugs that cost $300,000 a year?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one that is complex because the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation actually funded the development of this drug, and a lot of that funding came from donations from family and friends of people with CF. And in funding it, they retained the royalty rights to the drug. And so they were making millions and millions of dollars off the sale of it at first. And then they sold the rights to Kalydeco for $3.3 billion. I believe it was last year or 2 years ago. And that is enough to run the entire foundation for 15 years. And it is by far the largest drug royalty sale for a disease of this, you know, that affects so few people.
Nathan, we don't have much time, but I wanted to sneak you in here. Nathan from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hey, Leonard. I'm just calling about this idea of these diseases being cured. I have stage 4 cancer that I've been living with for the past 4 years. I'm on a clinical trial, and it's been very successful so far. But just the idea of a cure that is some kind of magic button that they can just turn on and go back to living their lives as they normally did before, which it was made very upfront to me when I started this trial that there is no hope for a cure. There's only the hope of this being a chronic disease. And I think the idea of a cure, people just think they can not change their lifestyle and continue to just behave in the same manner that in some cases contributed to something.
Well, Nathan, in cancer, we usually say it's gone into remission rather than it's been cured. So there's always that thought that it can come back.
And that's the case. I mean, that's actually what happened to me. I'm in my third remission. But, socially, in my peer group, you know, people are always asking, are you cured? And, you know, it's always been clear to me that there is no cure. There's just this idea, especially now in stage 4 and this trial that I'm on, is that it's the only hope is it to be a chronic disease like diabetes where I'm maintaining it.
We've run out of time, unfortunately, Nathan, but good luck with the treatments.
Thank you.
And thank you for calling us. And my great thanks to Jason Kebler, staff writer at Vice's Motherboard. His article is The Cure Culture. Thanks to all of you who have called in, and sorry we get to more of those calls.